Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, April 4, 2014. Dick Cheney is still at large. Dick Cheney is still bloodthirsty. Dick Cheney still wants to...
Bomb, 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 bomberan. Bomb, 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 bomberan. It's bomberan.
Remember when John McCain in 2008, in a froggy voice, campaign weary, tried to sing this to the press?
Went to Iraq, caught up the flag, no dirty bags of war, with intelligence attacking bomberman.
And let's credit Mother Jones, the scrappy investigative magazine from right here in San Francisco. They've done it again, and David Korn seems to be the go-to guy when, say, a bartender witnesses a secret gathering of Republicans. And that's what happened in Las Vegas recently when Sheldon Adelson, the casino billionaire, the guy who currently is spreading his money around trying to stop online gaming from competing with his brick-and-mortar casinos. That's his current agenda. Well, he held a meeting in Las Vegas, and all of the top Republicans showed up to kiss his ring and kiss his ass. Dick Cheney, joined by Big Fat Chris Christie of New Jersey, Jeb Bush, Scott Walker of Wisconsin, John Kasich of Ohio. And this was an off-the-record secret event. You and I are never supposed to know what was said. And I'll put up the link to Mother Jones because they've got the audio. And they put it up on their website. Dick Cheney has derided President Obama once again on foreign policy. He blasted the isolationists like Rand Paul in his own party. And he assailed critics of the National Security Agency. Speaking about the possibility of Iran developing a nuclear weapon, Cheney dismissed Obama's negotiations with Tehran. And he recalled a dinner meeting that he had in 2007 with Israeli General Amos Yadlin. Yadlin had been in the IDF in 81 and the mission that destroyed Iraq's Oserak nuclear reactor. And he was the military intelligence chief in 2007 when the IDF blew up the nuclear reactor of Syria in their Deir ez-Zor region. And recalling his conversation with the Israeli, Cheney said, well, he looked across the dinner table at me and said, two down, one to go. I knew exactly what he meant, Dick said cryptically. One to go was an obvious reference to bombing Iran's nuclear program, and the crowd responded with laughter and applause. And last October, Adelson himself publicly proposed that the U.S. drop bombs or something in the Iranian desert to show Tehran what would happen if Iran develops nuclear weapons. Now, before I resume the coverage of Dick Cheney's tirade, I want to tell you that last evening, I conducted two separate interviews with Gareth Porter, the journalist who's done deep investigation of what he calls in the title of his new book, The Manufactured Crisis, the untold story of the Iran nuclear scare. And we know from our own U.S. intelligence, NIE's national intelligence estimates from 2007 and forward, that Iran stopped whatever nuclear program it had in 2003. Dick Cheney knows that. And yet he teams up with Benjamin Netanyahu to pretend that there is this imminent threat that tomorrow or next week, Iran may surface with a nuclear weapon. It's simply not true. And Gareth Porter does an excellent job of tracing the history all the way back to the early 90s. And there were two forces that kind of flowed together. The U.S. intelligence community was looking for new threats to justify continuation of Cold War levels of budgets for intelligence and the Pentagon. And the Israelis, on their part, wanted to isolate Iran because, of course, Iraq had just been defeated in Desert Storm. And that was seen as strengthening Iran. And we'll have the audio from our live TV interview with Gareth Porter. I hope to get it later today, and as soon as I have it, I'll post it over the weekend sometime. It'll be available for our subscribers first. But it's a fascinating conversation with a man who knows a great deal about these issues. And, you know, it is to Obama's credit that he has brushed off the powerful forces of Israel and their allies in the U.S. Congress and not attacked Iran since he became president. And the talks that are underway now with Iran are showing great promise. And yet the neocons and the war hawks continue to try to tie the president's hands with additional sanctions. Israel continues to change the terms, trying to move from not just a nuclear weapons ban, but also to force Iran to disgorge its missiles. That's a deal breaker, and Israel knows it. So I find it amazing that Dick Cheney, even with somebody else's heart, continues to pump out this colossal bullshit. Now, in addition to his call to attack Iran, he said, without naming names, he slammed the less hawkish members of his own party, like Senator Rand Paul, for believing that the U.S. can afford to turn its back on that part of the world. One of the things that concerns me first about the campaign and that I'm worried about is what I sense to be increasing strain of isolationism in our own party, he said. It's not taking over by any means, but there is without question a body of thought, now that's supported by many Republicans and some candidates, that the United States can afford to turn its back on that part of the world. But he said anybody who thinks back on the problems of 9/11 knows it makes absolutely no sense. That's why he wants to destabilize yet another nation in Iran, in targeting Iran in the Middle East. And one of the things we discussed with Gareth Porter last night is the incredible arrogance of people who call for regime change. The arrogance being that they expect that they can control what would follow. And starting with Yugoslavia, then Iraq, more recently Libya, and prospectively Iran. If you blow the lid off of these countries, how do you control what follows? Now, we've managed to reinstall a dictatorship even more powerful than Mubarak, it appears at this point, in Egypt. But Libya remains a failed state with gun-running militias controlling different parts of it. And so the prospect of doing that to Iran, I find just maniacal and diabolical and frickin' crazy. That's what I would say. Now, finally, Cheney devoted much of his speech to defending the National Security Agency and its massive collection programs. He said there's the belief that we've created in the NSA this monster bureaucracy that's reading everybody's mail, listening to everybody's phone calls, infringing upon our civil liberties and civil rights. Hogwash, said Cheney. He claimed there hasn't been a single case of the NSA abusing its authority. Let's just cite one example. The FISA court that rolls over and rubber stamps everything the intelligence community asks for. And its outgoing chief judge, Reggie Walton, a big friend of the spooks who gagged Sybil Edmonds. Reggie Walton has complained that the NSA routinely lies to him. And so to claim that the NSA hasn't abused its authority, Mr. Cheney, that is flat out false. Earlier this week, the Supreme Court lifted the aggregate limit of about $116,000, whatever it was, on how much a fat cat can contribute to federal candidates in a given two-year cycle. Now it's unlimited. And one of the last vestiges of campaign finance reform is the fund that was set up where we check off $3 on our tax return, put money into the presidential campaign fund. Well, in a bizarre move, and I have to credit one of my Facebook friends for tipping me off on this, because I found it in the Guardian newspaper from Britain, not in the New York Times today. The president signed a bill yesterday that nominally diverts money for research into kids' diseases. He signed a bill called the Gabriella Miller Kids First Research Act. And it's going to steer money from that checkoff on our tax returns away from the presidential funding account and to pay for kind of unknown, at least to me, medical research. This is a bizarre move engineered by Republicans. Now, Barack Obama's hands aren't clean either, because he rejected the option of using public funding for his campaigns when he figured out he could raise much more without it. And so in 2008, he kind of late in the game, I believe it was in July or August, said, I don't think I'm going to accept that money and live under the limits. And then in 2012, he and Romney each raised about $1 billion, and outside entities spent at least another $500 million on each of those candidates. And so this is a really cynical move, engineered by Republicans, but approved by President Obama. He could have vetoed this bill and said, send me a clean bill that just funds kids first research. But instead, he signed the bill complete with the grieving family members of Gabriella Miller, who died of brain cancer at the age of 9. It was one of those photo ops where you just cringe because you know that these people are being used. And so the bill that he signed, calling it a wonderful way to remember a wonderful girl, well, he failed to mention that in the fine print it, quote, will terminate the entitlement of national committees of eligible political parties to payments from the Presidential Election Campaign Fund. Now, in the last two cycles, because the candidates rejected the federal funding, the money was diverted to pay for political conventions, which are now these big commercialized sponsored events. AT&T sponsored the last convention I went to, the Denver convention, where Obama was canonized. And so this is just such a distortion of the original intent of the effort to clean up campaign finance in this country. And in today, Friday's lead editorial at the New York Times, they make fun of Reince Priebus, the Republican Party chairman, and not because of his name. That's a good place to start, if you ask me. It says Reince Priebus was practically giddy on Wednesday, imagining the riches he can squeeze from the big private bank accounts as a result of the Supreme Court decision. But actually, says the Times, it is the big donors who will be squeezing the parties, not the other way around. They now have far more power to dictate terms to politicians and will soon begin issuing demands to benefit their special interests. Why? Well, donors now have an array of choices in how to spend their political dollars. They can dump it into super PACs, those that disclose their donors, or the nonprofit versions that don't. They can now, according to the McCutcheon decision, give directly with the $2,600 per candidate limit to as many candidates as they want to buy. And in a memo from a big law firm that represents politicians, Covington and Burling, a quote here, the difference here is that unlike with super PACs, elected politicians are able to request the contributions directly from the high net worth donor. This decision will allow power to collect around any member of Congress who can command a national or regional base of wealthy donors. And as I've pointed out, what that means, too, is that we have nationalized these campaigns. You may think that your congressional representative serves a specific district where you live, but they're going to be more responsive to the big money they get, no matter where it comes from. And in most cases, that's well outside the district. I'm grateful to the people who support this podcast. And today, I want to just mention one person. And at the end of the podcast, I'm going to read a letter that he sent me. But Stuart Smith of Brownfield, Maine, has been a longtime subscriber, and he just renewed for another year. And I will tip you off that the money he sent came from a tainted source. And we will explain that when I read his letter later. Will you join Stuart Smith and the others who support my podcast? I'm asking you directly, and it's tax time. My finances are quite crunched, and I could really use some new subscribers and anybody else who wants to support me. So go to my website, look under my picture on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. It says sign up, click on that. You get to choose a $1 24-hour pass, $5 a month, $10, $20 a month if your budget permits. Our best deal is that $50 annual subscription, and our current bonus gift offerings for new annual subscribers in the U.S. include this rock and roll CD called Red Flag by John Dist, a lot of good tunes on here, and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans from Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. And don't forget, subscriber or not, you can support us by taking advantage of the free trial offer at audible.com. Just click on the banner ad at peterbcollins.com, and you sign up for a month. They give you your first audiobook download free. If you cancel before 30 days, you don't have to pay Audible a penny. And in any event, they'll pay me $15 for referring you. It's a win-win, so please, when you have a chance, click on over and do that. Kevin Gostola is a great young journalist who writes multiple posts every day at firedoglake.com. And last summer, he provided excellent gavel-to-gavel coverage of the court-martial proceedings against Chelsea Manning at Fort Meade, Maryland, and contributed to our program on a regular basis. And I single him out for praise because he published the best article I've seen about the plea bargain of Stephen Kim. He is the second person who leaked information to a reporter who is pleading guilty to violating the Espionage Act. And he became the third person under Barack Obama to be sentenced to prison for the unauthorized disclosure of national defense information. Yes, Obama has locked up more people accused of spying and whistleblowing than anyone else. And what's significant about Stephen Kim is that he's a low-level guy. And the leak that he is accused of was to James Rosen, who works for Fox News. And what Kim fed to Rosen was information about North Korea. And it included embarrassing disclosures about U.S. intelligence, saying that we had lost track of components of North Korea for a long-range missile. Now, no sources or methods for intelligence gathering were revealed. Rosen drew minimal attention to the part of the disclosed information that could have truly embarrassed intelligence officials. Nonetheless, while top-ranking officials of any spook agency can leak with impunity, Stephen Kim's going to spend 13 months in a federal prison. And they made clear that the government doesn't consider him a whistleblower. He didn't think he was disclosing government waste, fraud, or abuse. No, just a failure of intelligence. And so the judge also limited the scope of possible defenses by narrowing the issue, saying that the government only had to prove that national defense information was released. And Abby Lowell, who defended Mr. Kim, had this to say. Lower-level employees like Kim are prosecuted because they're easier targets or often lack the resources or political connections to fight back. High-level employees leak classified information to forward their agenda or to make an administration look good with impunity. In fact, in this case, news reports from the same day demonstrate that Stephen was not the only government employee discussing the topic at issue. He may have told the reporter what the reporter already knew from others, but he was the only one charged. Thank you, Barack Obama, who claims to be the most transparent president in American history. On another front, the crackdown on Barrett Brown, the activist journalist who got the book thrown at him because he posted a link in a chat room from information that was hacked from the Strat4 website. Strat4 is this private intelligence agency that parallels the CIA, hires a lot of its former employees, and serves corporate interests with intelligence. It is a parallel CIA. And Brown was originally charged with 17 counts, mostly relating to a link that he posted in an internet chat room that in turn linked to a website that contained some hacked email addresses. And in those were credit card details. All that came from the Strat4 website. Now, he didn't do anything with that data. He simply posted a link. Others may have accessed it. But let me just use the example of the keys to someone's house. And if you're walking down the street and on the sidewalk or in the gutter, you see a keychain, and you think, well, maybe it belongs to the person at this house. So you take the keychain and let's say you put it on the mailbox. Then somebody else walks by, sees that keychain, picks it up and enters the house. Maybe they steal some stuff. Are you responsible because you originally picked up that keychain and put it where somebody else could find it? It is bizarre. Now, the scaled-down indictment alleges Brown's involvement as an accessory to the Strat4 hack by, quote, creating confusion regarding the identity of the hacker. The second charge, obstructing the execution of a search warrant, relates to attempts by Brown and his mother to hide a laptop during a search of her home in March of 2012, and the mom was charged with obstruction, given 6 months probation. Wired Magazine is reporting this, and they say that with 11 key charges dropped, the maximum sentence that he's now facing is about 5 years. We reported recently on the courageous non-citizens locked up in private prisons under the control of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Division of the Homeland Security Department, ICE. Now, the ACLU is suing because ICE has retaliated against about 20 of those immigrant hunger strikers at a Washington detention facility that's near Tacoma. There are about 1,300 people there, and as you may know, the most barbaric confinement facilities in the United States are these private detention facilities run by corporations. If you get sent there, you've got no rights. You might be completely disappeared, separated from your family, and really just subject to the whims of the immigration authorities as to when they might deport you and under what terms. So about 750 of these prisoners participated in a hunger strike about a month ago. 3 days later, guards asked several of the detainees if they would like to meet with an assistant warden. And those who raised their hands were immediately handcuffed and placed in solitary confinement. Now, I think if you did that in a federal prison and you did that to an American citizen, those guards would be subject to prosecution. No such risk to the guards at a private prison. And I hope the ACLU prevails in this case. The peace talks that John Kerry has been trying to nudge and nurture between Israel and the Palestinians are falling apart even more. Yesterday, we told you that the Palestinians have filed with the United Nations for membership in 15 international conventions and treaties. This is seen by Israel as a double cross, that the Palestinians have violated an agreement that they had made. So, tit for tat, and Israel's really good at that. They said that they will not follow through on the release of the final 25% of the group of prisoners that they agreed to release at the outset of this renewal of talks. And I believe Israel is posturing so that they get Jonathan Pollard in exchange only for continuing to come to the peace table and obstruct the process. Turkey has lifted its ban on Twitter. YouTube is still unavailable in that country. And there's more fallout from the revelations by the Associated Press yesterday about this not covert, not clandestine. It was just a discreet program in Cuba, where the U.S. Agency for International Development, widely seen as the it's the up periscope arm of the CIA. And they funded this two-year program for a kind of knockoff of Twitter called Zunzuneo in Cuba. And before they left it, they had attracted 40,000 users. And the apparent idea was that they were going to be able to collect information on these people and then selectively feed them information to help destabilize the government in Havana. And, of course, the White House says, oh, no. We were just trying to provide a service to the Cuban people. It's amazing. And they take us for such fools. One guy who's been playing us for a fool for far too long is about to step down as the president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai. There are elections coming up this weekend. If the past is any predictor, they will not be credible elections. Someone will surface. Karzai will hand off power, but he's planning to move into the house next door to the official residence and remain an influential player in Afghan politics. That probably doesn't advance anybody's interests. So who do you believe? The self-appointed government in Kiev or the president that they displaced? At issue is who ordered the snipers to fire on protesters in Maidan Square. And Thursday, the acting interior minister of Ukraine, Arsen Avakov, said that it was a special group within the capital's Berkut riot police, known as the Black Company, whose officers were dressed in black uniforms with yellow armbands and armed with Kalashnikovs and sniper rifles. And he's accusing them of killing at least 17 protesters on February 20th. Yanukovych denies it. He says that he never ordered snipers to kill anyone. And I have to say that while I wasn't there and probably will never know, I'm more likely to believe Yanukovych. David Letterman has decided he's going to hang it up. Next year, when his contract expires, he will be done with late-night television. He's been on the air, 33 years, something like that? And occasionally, I have found him funny. But I think he's smart to quit while he still has an audience. And I can just imagine that since late night is now dominated by young guys named Jimmy Fallon, and Jimmy Kimmel, that CBS is out there looking for a young comic named Jimmy that they can replace David Letterman with. As I mentioned, I'm really touched by the handwritten 2-page letter that Stuart Smith sent on stationery with his name on it. I remember. I used to have stationery with my name on it. And to get a handwritten letter in the mail is so rare and kind of precious today. And he wrote to explain that on his birthday, he received $100 in cash from his dad. And he peeled off one of those $50 bills and put it in the mail to pay for his renewed subscription to the Peter B. Collins podcast. And, Stuart, I'm very grateful for that. It kind of suggests that cash is tight in your household and this bonus money you wanted to direct to me, well, I'm very appreciative and touched by that. And so he explains that his 83-year-old father spent 40 years at a company called Quaker City Gear in Pennsylvania. But his pension was stolen when the son of the owner took possession of the company during the Reagan years. So his dad was on the edge of bankruptcy when the fracking scheme came to the rescue. He said that dad resisted selling out and signing an agreement to let the frackers onto his property. But after everybody else succumbed, well, Dad said, there's nothing to be gained by holding out here. And so he said, you are now a recipient of the proceeds from the vast fracking Ponzi scheme. And Stewart made some other comments, too, and I appreciate them. And he also apologized for his handwriting, which is better than mine. Thank you, Stewart. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being so generous. And thanks for telling me that you sent me tainted money. It spends just like anything else. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thank you for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again.